Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks. This is Priya Menon, joining you from India, and we are kickstarting 2018 with a discussion on multiple myeloma. The myeloma panel is led by Gary Peterson, myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, and co-host of today's show. Joining Gary on the panel are myeloma survivors and advocates Jack Aiello, Cynthia Shmulevsky, and Matt Goldman. Welcome to Cure Talks. The featured expert on today's talk is Anne Quinn Young of the Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. And it's such a pleasure to have you with us again.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah. The MMRF is pioneering precision medicine initiatives in multiple myeloma. This would help match patients with the most effective therapies based on their genetics and other unique factors. Today, Anne will share myeloma research initiatives at the MMRF, specifically cover the MMRF Compass study updates, MMRF Answer Fund program, clinical trials currently recruiting, and opportunities that patients can explore to share their data and participate in research efforts to accelerate precision medicine. As always, we will be taking questions from audience towards the end of the discussion. Please send in your questions to priya@trialx.com or post it in the comment section on curetalks.com. Or you can also press 1 on your telephone keypads and we can bring you on air to ask your question. With that, I will now hand it over to Gary to begin with the discussion. Gary, you're on air.
Yes. hello, Anne Quinn Young. How are you? And welcome to
I'm good. Hi, Gary.
Yeah. Yeah. You need a few more names, though. No. But in any event, Anne is the Senior Vice President of Marketing and Communications at the MMRF, where she leads brand strategy and execution of marketing and communication efforts across all the channels. But most of all,
Gary, I can't hear you.
Gary, can you hear us? Oh, I think we just dropped and, Gary there. Start off. Yeah, there he is. Gary, we miss you for some time.
Oh, you miss me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yeah, we can hear
you. You were in the middle of my introduction, and you dropped off with most of all and dot, dot, dot.
Oh, well, and most of all, what I said was that you happen to be, for the patients, the face of the MMRF. And the person that we most often see at, patient seminars and things like that. So we appreciate everything that you do and letting us know what efforts that you guys put forth for us. And so thank you very much. And welcome again. It's a pleasure to hear what MMRF is doing to keep us alive. Hey, did I drop off again?
Oh, you're there.
No,
you're here. Thank you, Gary. Thank
you. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I'm hoping not. In any event, now that the MMRF, one of its key initiatives is the COMPASS trial, and that's been in place for some time now, could you please give us an update on the results of that trial to date and what you believe, as you look into your crystal ball, what will come out of this in the future?
Well, thank you, Gary and Priya and Jack and Cindy and Matt. Honestly, I love being part of this and look forward to every year. It's a little scary how quickly the year goes by and all of a sudden it's January again. But it's such a pleasure to do this with, such old friends and, patients who are making such a difference in the lives for thousands and thousands of other patients. And I'm always so impressed, too, by how well-informed everyone, all of you are. It's truly inspirational. So to answer Gary's question, for those of you listening on the line who aren't familiar with the MMRF Compass study, It's a study that we launched back in 2011, and the goal was at the time, you know, and it still is the goal, to map out the different subtypes of myeloma. We all know, you know, all the patients, all the caregivers on the call know that myeloma differs tremendously from patient to patient in terms of which treatments you respond to, your, you know, the side effects, the symptoms, the complications, the duration of response to therapy. And what we really wanted to do with the, you know, the availability of whole genome sequencing is to understand the disease at its deepest level and start to understand what those subtypes of patients may be and how best to treat them. So we launched a very ambitious $40 million study to follow over 1,000 patients longitudinally, and that means, you know, around 8 years, to understand the course of their disease and really deeply profile them at key points. So a challenge, you know, in the beginning was to enroll these patients because we needed 1,000 patients prior to treatment. So there were a number of patients who had to have a repeat bone marrow done, and we're so grateful that they raised their hand to be part of this. So we sequenced patients prior to the initiation of treatment, and then we sequenced them at each time that they relapse as well, and throughout are collecting clinical data. So by the time we closed enrollment in 2015, it took 76 centers in 4 countries to get us to that 1,000, and actually 1,150 patients, because we have a data sharing agreement with some Italian centers. So it's amazing. I mean, it's such a tremendous resource. It's the largest genomics data set of any cancer. So breast cancer, prostate cancer, all these cancers that are have so many more patients, we have the largest genomics data set because we have 3 types of sequencing, not just on every patient, but on every patient sample. So what we've learned so far is, you know, from a clinical level, we've helped validate answers to questions that are also being validated through larger randomized trials. Like a couple of years ago, it was obvious that being treated with 3 drugs versus 2 up front led to a longer progression-free survival. And again, it was great for us to see, because when this was presented at ASH, the IFM, you know, Dana-Farber study presented similar data in a randomized trial. So we had real-world evidence of this going on. They had a trial, and indeed, now the standard, you know, for most patients is 3 drugs versus 2. Now, what the COMPASS study will also help us understand when we, you know, interrogate the databases, are there patients who only need 2? Are there 2 drugs, you know, whether it's a, you know, proteasome inhibitor and a steroid or an IMiD and a steroid? You know, and that obviously would save the patient toxicities, costs, and all that. But those are the type of questions that we can ask. Another one that, you know, the early data started to confirm as well, and similar data came out of the IFM DFCI study, was that having a transplant earlier, you know, again, was better than waiting. Same question, though, with the 3 versus 2. You know, the challenge in front of us is to interrogate the data to say, okay, which patients really don't benefit from transplant? So don't go through all that a transplant requires you to do, because you're not going to benefit, versus, you know, the patients that really should, because they do, you know, have a benefit. What we're starting to learn now, and we don't have real data to share yet, but as follow-up continues, is start to answer the question around maintenance. Certainly, the, you know, studies that have gone on are indicating treating until progression, but we'll be able to see through COMPASS, start to see through COMPASS, are there patients who that's not necessary, or are there patients who, you know, benefit more from a proteasome inhibitor versus an IMiD? Those are the really, I think, easy to understand answers that, or things that we've learned through COMPASS.
What is the measure of the genetic measure? Is it gene expression profiling or?
It's whole genome sequencing, whole exome sequencing, and RNA sequencing. So on every every event for every patient. We gather that data. That's what makes it the largest data set. So it's not the largest data set in terms of the number of patients. It's just the, and I don't know what the size is, but when we, for example, put our data or made our data available to the Genomic Data Commons, which, you know, had, I want to say, like 30 different data from like 30 different cancers from the Cancer Genome Atlas program, we added like 50% more data on there just with our one study in myeloma. So, you know, what we're primarily learning and, you know, just coming out of ASH, there are about 25 different abstracts in Compass, is primarily in the area of new targets and starting to understand possible, you know, mechanisms of resistance and response, and a big area, a big focus on defining high-risk patients. Because of the treatments available to newly diagnosed patients now, thankfully, most patients on Compass haven't relapsed yet. So they're still in remission, either following their, you know, first-line therapy or first-line therapy followed by transplant and most on maintenance. The patients who, you know, relapse in the first, you know, with under 2 years, those are the patients we're really starting to learn from and starting to, you know, come up with some hypotheses in terms of what constitutes high risk. And indeed, there have been a number of new targets found and also signatures that need to be validated that, you know, hopefully will allow us to better identify high-risk patients, because unfortunately the current, you know, ways to identify patients, high-risk patients, aren't very predictive. And even actually one of the most interesting things, I think, useful things that have been found through Compass, and Gary kind of gets to your question about, you know, what was done, and we could only learn this through sequencing. So most on the call know that if you're a patient who said you have deletion of chromosome 17p, that's bad. But what we learned through Compass, and really you need sequencing to do this, not FISH, is it has to be both copies of 17P or P53 or gone. Jonathan Keith from TGen, who is a partner in Compass, uses an analogy that I think is amazing. If P53 is a tumor suppressor gene, if you only cut, it's like a car. You have two sets of brakes, the front and the back. You cut off the front, you can still stop the car. It may not stop quite as well, but you can still stop it. You cut off both, you're not stopping it. So, you know, what we found, if you're missing only one copy, those patients do pretty much as well as other patients, as, you know, and so there is a group of deletion 17P patients out there who, you know, have been told you're high risk who probably aren't. So, you know, what we need to do, and this kind of gets to the crystal ball question, is how do we start to take some of these learnings like that into practice so that sequencing is validated and paid for and made more widely available so that patients have a better understanding not only of their risk and prognosis, but also, you know, as we start to better understand, you know, targeted therapy, which treatments they're most likely to benefit from. And then the other piece that we're also starting to look at is along the lines of the, you know, frontline 3 versus 2, can we, you know, start looking at, you know, treatments for first relapse or second relapse, third relapse, and almost see, are there pathways that we may want to share with insurers, for example, you know, to help them understand, you know, the real world response. You know, it's not a randomized clinical trial, but can give some indication and perhaps justification for the coverage of these agents for patients.
Did they, did it, you know, in the analysis, did it come up with what the best free drug combination is, for example? The reason I asked you know, I saw that KRD just came out and said that they had a 9-month improvement over RD, but VRD versus RD had like a 13-month improvement, but that was with newly diagnosed patients. So, you know, It was a little confusing that under one condition, like newly diagnosed, VRD shows, you know, improved progression-free survival versus KRD versus the same thing in relapse patients, you know, just the difference. So,
yep.
So it's not so apples to apples, but it was a little confusing.
And so you asked a good question. I pulled up the latest COMPASS data, and that's not in there, but I do know the answer to the question. So in the COMPASS data, as you can imagine, the most commonly used not only triplet but regimen was RVD. And KRD, because a lot of those 76 sites are community, and also, you know, you have to remember when this started back in 2011, the use of KRD up front was not widespread by any means. So I don't believe it's statistically significant, but the best outcome, at least from the last data I saw, was KRD up front. But again, I don't think there were enough patients to make it statistically significant.
Okay. Thank you. One of the things that I noticed, and I was surprised being, you know, from a business environment, is that, you know, we generate all this data and it just goes for naught. And yours is probably one of the first, if not the very first, close to being one of the first, that have actually tried to capture that data. And recently I saw that somebody partnering with a company called CancerLink, and they were trying to mine data from 1 million cancer patients. And will COMPASS be able to tie into this big data program?
So we have spoken to ASCO. The big challenge here are really twofold. So it's 1 million cancer patients, but a much smaller number of myeloma patients. And the amount of genomic information is very limited, is my understanding. So I would say more broadly, I'd say for the past 2 or 3 years, we've been in discussions with a number of different, you know, both centers and companies about sharing data. And it's not that, you know, not even that we would say, okay, you know, dump your data into our database, but if there are certain, you know, research questions that require more data, you know, could we create a model where that data is, you know, the data is pulled together in a safe place where, again, we don't get full access to their data, but it's being combined with COMPASS to answer some questions. We don't have any firm commitments. I think we're getting closer. I do think there are some academic centers who are talking more about data sharing and in a public way, because, you know, often you'll hear centers talking about data sharing, and it's really, you know, with each other as opposed to the public. And again, our data, the COMPASS data, is open to any nonprofit researcher. So at an academic center, the for-profit is a little bit different, who wants access to it. And I think I told this anecdote last year, but if I didn't, you know, this is one example of opening up it even beyond, you know, medical researchers or, you know, PhD researchers in cancer. We opened up the data about a little over a year ago via this company called TopCoder, who, you know, has all of these, like, all I can describe, like, data scientists across the board. All they do is crunch data. They're agnostic to where, you know, the kind of data it is, to come up with predictive models. And, you know, we put the question out there. It was a $30,000 reward to say, can you come up with a predictive signature for patients who are more likely to relapse within, you know, X amount of time. And the winner, the most predictive signature, came from a guy working in the forensics department of the Rio de Janeiro Police Department. So, it you know, we're now working with TopCoder, and this is also through Harvard Business School, to validate the data, and it's with another data set. So there are places where there is data sharing going on, and we're appreciative because using just COMPASS data alone, and thankfully there aren't that many relapses, we don't know if this is just a numbers thing, and in the real world it's not going to play out, or when you put it with different data, it's going to play out. So it's I think bringing many others into the field is important, but we're not governed by the same incentives that for-profit companies or academic centers are. So and I'm not apologizing for them, but it's more challenging for them to open up their data when they're worried about publishing and IP and all of that. And we don't, we don't have those concerns.
Well, I'm just, like an old boss of mine once said, he says, you cannot manage that which you do not measure. And I'm just so thankful that you guys are and the answers I know are in the data, and the data
right.
is there or will be there. And I'm just thankful that now we're making decisions based on 1,000 people versus a clinical trial with 30 or 40, which makes, statistically a pretty bad sample. What would you, could you please explain the ANSWER Fund program and how it will benefit patients?
Right. Well, and you teed that up perfectly in terms of the answers and the data. So, what we started to observe, I'd say about a year ago, was that, we were thrilled that, at that time there was like 40 different abstracts or publications, analyzing the COMPASS data. But it was all questions that an individual researcher was asking, would say, I'm interested in this target, or I'm interested in, predicting, high risk, whatever it may be, and that's, that was what was published or presented. So what we thought, these are not necessarily questions that patients would have or would have, immediate or short-term benefit for patients. So we launched what we called the ANSWER Fund, and it's basically a pot of money to answer questions using the COMPASS data and other data sets as well, to answer questions that matter to patients. So we put out, the first one is still around high risk. It's, I think as everyone in the panel would agree, is still the area of greatest unmet need right now. So we put out an RFP, and we'll be announcing the winners shortly for that. And that's really around, coming up with figuring out a better, how to validate, what some kind of, whether it's biomarkers or predictive signature, and then, potential treatment options for a high risk, or at least some subset of high risk patients. We also, last fall, and I know a number, some of you, Jack included, helped us test this through a company called IdeaScale. We went out to all the patients in our database and on social media to say, what are your questions? What questions would you like to see answered using COMPASS data? We had something like 200 different questions, many more interactions in terms of people liking other people's questions or commenting on them. So we're in the process of selecting a question and putting it, which probably, but don't quote me on this, will be around maintenance therapy, and putting that out for an RFP in the first half of this year. So again, kind of stay tuned for that, but the ANSWER Fund really is to make sure we have money set aside to do analytics on questions that don't matter just to, researchers in the lab, but also to patients. Are you still there, Gary? No. Can you hear me?
Yes, and Jack, probably you can ask a question for Anne.
Sure, glad to, and a belated Happy New Year, Anne.
Thank you, you too.
So all my questions are related to a webinar that was conducted by the MMRF, specifically Faith Davis, Drs. Faith Davis and David Siegel gave it earlier this month to discuss what happened at ASH. But Dr. Davis also talked about a trial called, referred to as My Drug. And so I had a few questions on it because it was unclear to me. She presented a slide that said it's for functional high-risk patients. And so I was wondering, does functional high-risk mean different than high-risk? Does it perhaps mean dual deletion 17p53 as per your comment earlier? Or can you expand on that?
Sure. And you know, for those of you who weren't on the webinar, it was earlier this month, and highlights from ASH. And this specific slide came from a presentation that our head of research, Dr. Daniel Auclair, presented at ASH. And it wasn't on my drug specifically, but it was on a different study. This study is not longitudinal, but it is sequencing relapsed patients. It's our molecular profiling protocol. And we've sequenced almost 400 patients from that, and Daniel was presenting the data in terms of how many patients, you know, as a result of, you know, being sequenced, you know, got into a clinical trial, got on a targeted therapy, what was the frequency of alterations reported. And he showed this at the end, this slide at the end, talking about my drug, because it's our way of, you know, kind of the final step in terms of precision medicine. We're generating data through Compass and, you know, other initiatives like that. We're dedicated to the analytics through partnerships with, you know, folks like GNS and the answer, driving analytics through the Answer Fund. And then, you know, but to really matter to patients, we need to drive it to the clinic. And because of some of the mutations that we've seen either through our original genomics initiative or through Compass may only be seen in 5, 10, 15% of patients, the best way, the most efficient way, or probably the only way to do this in a disease called multiple myeloma is through a master protocol or a platform trial. And this is where we would screen patients, and Jack, I promise I will get to your question, but just to give everyone the background, we would screen patients using that panel, and then if they had one of the alterations that was in one of the, you know, 6 to 8 arms, they'd be assigned to that arm, and if they had nothing, they would be assigned to a control arm. And again, all of these arms of the trial, it's one single trial, so we're not opening 8 separate trials and trying to come up with, you know, it would take many, many different sites, and it would take a long time and cost a lot of money. So doing I-SPY, for those of you on the call who may have heard of this, is that kind of study. You have one protocol, but then you have different, more than two arms, which is obviously one or two arms, which is standard for phase 1, 2, 3 trials. So to answer your question about functional high risk, it has nothing to do with genomics or anything else. It's, have you relapsed after initial therapy within 2 years? That's what we're calling functional high risk. And it goes back to a lack of, you know, consistency or validation or, you know, predictive ability to say who truly is high risk. So we're going solely on, did you fail your initial therapy within or progress in your initial therapy within 2 years? And then the current arms of the trial, mostly, not entirely, are associated with higher risk. You know, by our targets that may indicate higher risk disease.
So it's for relapsed refractory patients who have relapsed within 2 years of initial treatment?
Correct.
And is it taking patients from Compass, or is this completely open to those patients that qualify per what you just indicated?
So completely open to those patients who qualify. We're looking at opening it at hopefully all 25 of our MMRC, our Clinical Research Network sites, potentially others as well. And, you know, we'll also, whether it's Compass or probably more the molecular profiling protocol, because FDA with these types of studies would like patients to be screened using one assay, because, again, there is quite a bit of, there can be some inconsistency. So if, for example, you were profiled, you know, 6 months earlier, we could, you know, we could alert your doctor, hey, that patient has this alteration, you know, he or she may be eligible for this trial. So you may not need to get another bone marrow to be tapped for this, or at least told about it.
So I know you're aware that a few years ago, NCI opened up something called the MATCH trial, which looks at different cancers, but it again looks at mutations associated with those cancers, and if you have one of those mutations, it gives you a particular drug that's effective against it. And it recently opened up for myeloma. So is this similar to that, except for the fact that it will be specifically for myeloma and handle more patients?
So it's similar. You know, you bring up a good point. There are different ways to set these things up. You can do it by disease, and then the arms are by target, or you can do it like NCI did. It's really target, and then disease. You know, then the disease falls under the target. I haven't checked. I will do so after the call. I don't believe any of the arms overlap. I think in the MATCH trial, but I will, at least with you, Jack, separately confirm this, that they have different alterations. Because these, most of the ones here, not RAF and RAS, but some of the others, like FGFR3, it is seen in a couple of others, like bladder cancer, but it's mostly a myeloma alteration. Versus, obviously, NCI was looking at alterations that are common across many different cancers. So like a BRAF, I believe is part of the MATCH study, and we don't have that.
And by the way, just for the audience sake, you're calling it alteration, I'm calling it mutation, but we're talking the same thing, right?
Yes. Yep. I've been trained by my scientist. I've been trained by the scientist. I've been around the scientists too long. Alteration, but yes, same thing.
So
I guess mutation suggests something bad, and alteration, it may be good. You know, it may be something that confers a better prognosis.
Okay. I'll buy that.
Yeah.
On the chart, I'm trying to understand also, it said, for example, I'm looking at the chart, which says if you have T1114, it
yep.
says that the treatment would be a BCLI plus a backbone regimen. And I assume
yep.
by BCLI you're talking about like something like venetoclax.
Correct. Yep.
And I wonder what the backbone regimen is, and is the backbone regimen the same for all of these different arms?
Yep. So, yes, the backbone regimen is Ninlaro Pomdex.
Ah, okay. So it's an all-oral.
And so it's yeah, exactly. So all oral, and, at least in the case of Pom, maybe a little bit, I guess there's an assumption, too, that perhaps you failed Revlimid already, so going to Pom, and then the convenience of all oral.
And
the,
would
the,
you...
I was just going to say, we're approximating 40 to 50% will not have one of these actionable alterations or mutations. So they would go into, they would be the quote-unquote control, but it's not really, I wouldn't say it's so much a control as we're looking at two arms for that one, and one of them would be a novel immunotherapy like a BCMA antibody or BiTE, and then the other one, TBD.
Got it. And when do you expect this trial to start opening up?
Q3.
Of this year.
Of this year, yep.
And I always appreciate talking with you and your very clear answers, and I'll turn it either back to Gary if he's on, or just forward it to Cindy.
Okay, thanks, Jack.
Yes, Cindy, why don't you do this? You're always the last one up, so this time we'll change that for you. Cindy, are you there? Well, then
can you
let's
hear me
go to Meg.
I'm here.
Yes.
Can you hear?
Okay.
Yeah, I was unmuted because my dog was barking, but I unmuted myself. Hi, Ann. How you doing?
So I'm good. How are you doing, Cindy? Yeah, I was going to say, I saw I saw something that you're going away, that I thought you were in Europe. I'm like, is she calling from Europe for this?
No, I'm going away in March to the EBMT, so I'll be there.
That's awesome. Yeah, I saw that. That's, you're all over the place speaking, and that's great. That's phenomenal.
So what I would like to learn a little bit more about is I see that, you know, the MMRF founder, Kathy Juicy, is part of this Craft Precision Medicine Accelerator Project. Can you tell us a little bit about what that project is?
Sure. So it's a program up at Harvard Business School. Robert Kraft, a very successful businessman, for those of you who know, he's the owner of the Patriots. So depending on where you live, you may feel one way or another about him, but truly a tremendous philanthropist as well. His wife a few years ago was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, late stage. They lived up in Boston. Was able to have her tumor sequenced, and she did have an actionable alteration mutation. But sadly, she passed away before being able to get into the trial. So he feels very passionately about cancer and making a difference in cancer, but also about the promise of precision medicine. But interestingly, when he, decided to make a donation of $20 million, he made it to the business school and not to the medical school or to the Broad Institute or the many other, amazing research programs up in Boston. So once, Harvard Business School got the funding, the dean reached out to Kathy because, he knew that, she'd been very much focused on precision medicine and one cancer, to say, would you serve as co-chair with Richard Haramesh, who's a professor emeritus up at the business school. So Kathy has been co-chair for almost a couple of years there. She splits her time, although splitting her time means she's pretty much 100% MMRF, 100% up there as well. And she and Richard structured the program, or really the goal is to bring best practices of precision medicine to all cancers. Similar to what we were talking about in terms of the MMRF sharing data, it's really about, sharing knowledge, sharing best practices. There are four different work streams, one focused on data, one focused on direct-to-patient efforts, one focused on innovative trials, and the initial focus is platform trials like MyDrug, and one is on new funding streams, like, alternative funding streams, non-philanthropy, like venture. So within those four areas, there are leaders. The leader on clinical trials, for example, is Dixie Esseltine. So for those of you who have been around a while, she helped bring Velcade to market and was at Millennium, then Takeda for a very long time. And each of them has a number of different nonprofits. We meet and have share best practices, but also both within ourselves, but also with the goal of publishing. So Kathy and Richard have already published a number of articles within Harvard Business Review. They're launching an executive ed course in the fall. I sit on the direct-to-patient group with four other cancers, and it's been tremendous. On the data side. And one of the first projects of the accelerator was to put together a full landscape of all of the cancer data sets, for-profit, not-for-profit, public domain, not public domain, and the Harvard Business School Library keeps that maintained, and that's available to anyone who wants to understand what the data landscape is. And our Compass study was circles, four quadrants and circles showing how big the data is, and Compass really stood out. But on the direct-to-patient side, there are some other groups who are doing amazing work and have done things that the MMRF has successfully done that the MMRF hasn't. So the Pancreatic Cancer Network, PanCAN, is one. It's one of those things where the MMRF is sharing knowledge, and so it's, you know, going beyond the myeloma field, but we're also taking learnings back as well. So there's things that I personally have learned that, you know, have really helped, I think, make the MMRF stronger in terms of some of our patient engagement and outreach strategies. And on the and then even on the trial side, a couple of the trials like iSpy and others have been underway that we can learn from and optimize and allow us to optimize my drug before we launch it. So there's tremendous synergy. And again, we're, you know, certainly having Kathy up there sharing a lot of what we've learned, but we're taking a lot back as well to the foundation and the community.
That's great. I agree. It's wonderful. Even like when patient advocates across cancer disease sites come together, because we do learn from each other and help each other out.
Yeah.
So that's good. Yep. The other question maybe you could go a little bit about is I think the MMRF is launching or has launched the molecular profile initiative. Can you tell us about that? Is it recruiting patients? And just explain a little bit more about that.
So that's what I was referring to in when I started to answer Jack's question. So it's a way for patients who are not enrolled in Compass. It's open to technically the protocol is open to all patients, but we are focusing on relapse patients, in terms of those patients having much more need for options than newly diagnosed patients. So if you're a relapse patient and you're looking to have your tumor sequenced, I believe it's open at all 25 MMRC sites. If not, it's at least 20 of them. We launched an RFP a couple of years ago. University of Michigan won. It's a myeloma specific panel. Within 7 to 10 days, your doctor, it requires a bone marrow biopsy, but your doctor will get the results within 7 to 10 days, and it's a very clear, simple report to say, okay, you know, you have this mutation. Here's a list of trials for you, or here's some off-label therapies. So what happens in those 7 to 10 days is the sample sequenced, and then a tumor board of doctors looks at it to help provide that report. As I mentioned earlier, from the data that Daniel presented, about 60-65% of patients have had an alteration, and the vast majority of those have been, or a significant number have either been put on a trial specific to that for that alteration or off-label therapy. So when we talk about, generating data, we also pull these data sets together because Compass, we have limited data on relapse patients, but here, we already have about 400. And in a few cases, we have multiple samples on the same patient. So we pull together our own data sets in addition to, looking for others that may be willing to share data.
So for any relapse refractory patient that's on the call, if they're not going currently to one of your sites, could they make a consultation at one of those sites if they
absolutely
wanted to be part of the okay? That's
absolutely. So either to get in touch with our patient support center, which is 866-603-6628, and that's probably the easiest way to do it. Or if you're want to do it yourself, just look up on our site one of the 25 different centers. And it's called the, if you get a consult, the molecular profiling protocol. And we started it with 500 slots. We've sequenced about 400, but we are looking at expanding because there's been, great demand and, certainly really good feedback from the doctors and the patients.
That's good to know. Speaking of this bone marrow biopsies that you have to have to be part of this MCI initiative, what is the MMRF doing along the lines of liquid biopsies And why are they important? Why are we hearing all this information about liquid biopsies now?
So this is an area that there's a lot of discussion at the MMRF, and certainly, you mentioned it, and it's been in the headlines, I think, at a number of these meetings. So what we've done, we have supported, through funding, some of these efforts, specifically Suzanne Trudell up in Princess Margaret. But what we're doing, putting this into practice, is for patients who are on Compass and who relapse, we'll be collecting both bone marrow and also we'll be sequencing the blood, but also the bone marrow, but also the blood. So that's exciting, and hopefully the bone marrow piece can go away. The challenge right now is these blood liquid biopsies are not CLIA grade yet. There's at least we haven't found one. If anyone on the call knows, let us know. But there's no CLIA grade one available, which means the results can't go back to your doctor. So with our molecular profiling protocol, because it is clinical grade, doctors can make clinical decisions based on the results of the panel. There's no CLIA grade liquid biopsy yet. So I will tell you, though, as a 2018 priority, we are very much focused on identifying, the right partner, but how do we make it CLIA grade so that it could potentially, in the not-so-distant future, replace bone marrow in terms of patients being monitored or, receiving the same information in terms of genomics, immune, what have you, MRD, simply from a blood sample as opposed to needing bone marrow.
That would be great. And Gary, why don't you have Matt ask his questions? I have a few others, but I think most of what my other questions were have been covered a little bit in our discussion. Thanks, Ann.
No, you're welcome. Thank you.
Matt, please ask your questions.
Okay. Hi, Ann.
Matt,
thanks
your questions?
Again for your time.
Hi, yep, Matt.
I'm here.
Oh, no, thank you.
Hi, Ann. Couple of questions. Does the Compass study, did you include individuals with smoldering myeloma? And if not, why not? And if so, what are some of the findings in terms of treating or not treating and things like that?
So Compass did not include smoldering patients. And the reason was because part of the eligibility criteria was requiring immediate treatment, requiring treatment. So obviously, right now, smoldering myeloma patients generally aren't treated and requiring treatment with an IMID and or proteasome inhibitor. So I've been thinking about what I say this on the call, but because there's been a couple of different places, but I think now is a good time. Keeping with the theme of data generation and building out a data bank to answer, to be able to, give every patient exactly what he or she needs in terms of the right treatment, the right combination, the right sequence, and also answer all of the questions that patients in the community have. We will be this year, in the first half of this year, announcing an effort to build upon these data sets, Compass obviously being the largest. And that effort will include all patients, including smoldering. So if you're smoldering or if you're, 15 years out, having been through many different lines of therapy, you would be eligible to become part of this next, wave of data collection. And there would also, back to Cindy's question, be part of that would also be liquid biopsy, so collecting data using blood samples versus bone marrow. I can't say a lot more about it yet, but certainly I'll keep everyone closely posted as we get closer to being able to announce this. But we're really excited about it. We hadn't thought a couple of years ago that type of effort may be necessary, but in terms of trying to find enough data to, you know, again, answer these questions. It's been harder than we thought, and technology is allowing us to launch a Compass Light study for much less than $40 million. So we're really excited about that.
Oh, good. And I'm curious, I was just, you know, looking at some of the stats from the Compass study. How do you reach out to people, and how do you get people to join? And I think the thing for me that jumped out is the percentage of African Americans in the Compass study is pretty low, and I'm wondering why that is, or does that represent something bigger?
So it's funny you say that, because one reason why we're proud of Compass, and thank you for bringing this up, because I did mean to say it earlier, is it really does generally represent the full face of multiple myeloma. So when you look at clinical trials, you know, they're often biased toward, you know, a little bit younger patient, a little bit healthier patient, you know, African Americans tend to be underrepresented. Actually, the proportion of myeloma patients who are African American is almost 20%. So the 16% is actually really good. It's only a little bit smaller than the, you know, the full representation. So we're pretty proud of that. It's not, mm-hmm. so it sounds low, but it actually represents the proportion within the greater community. And when you look at, you know, things like age, we had patients enroll who were, I wish I had these stats in front of me. I don't, who I think were like in their early 20s, so early mid 20s, and then all the way up until their late 80s. So again, you know, particularly those elderly patients may not be those in clinical trials, but we have, again, a study that does represent a pretty good snapshot of what myeloma looks like in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then, just,
thanks.
You know, another point that you didn't ask, but it relates to the very first question that Gary asked in terms of what we're learning. One publication that came out late last year of looking at Compass data and African Americans in the Compass data, interestingly found that a couple of things. One, there was a lower incidence of high-risk disease. So, you know, for African American patients, they were less likely to have some of these traditional high-risk features. And then the second piece, which is, you know, what we've seen too, is that when treated the same, you know, when receiving the same treatments, you know, they do, you know, there's no differences in terms of outcome based on, you know, race or ethnicity. So when you see, you know, particularly in other cancers, that there are those disparities, at least in myeloma, it suggests that, you know, given those two pieces of data, it suggests that it's just getting inferior care. So as long as, you know, patients get the same level of care, they do as well or better.
Okay, thanks. And then lastly, you touched on this in your opening about findings about transplant versus non-transplant. I guess, is there much you can say about who transplants do benefit and who they don't, or is there not much you can say at this point in time?
No, we don't. You know, I have to say, and I may even take this on as an advocate, I think that's the perfect question to answer, like through the Answer Fund. We hired late last year someone on our scientific team, a PhD, who, you know, has a genomics and data background, that she alone may be able to look at the data and start to develop some hypotheses. But, I do think it is important for our community to start to understand, okay, we understand, you know, when looking at the entire population, you know, having an early transplant is better. But when you start to drill down to specific patient subtypes, are there ones who it doesn't really matter, and or are there ones who just should skip transplant altogether because based on their alterations, there's no way that, you know, they have a low probability of getting a good or durable response.
Right. Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. So we can take some questions from the audience now. If you have a question for Ran, please press 1 on your keypad or just send the question over to priya@tralix.com. And we have a couple of questions that have already come in. First one is, with this accelerated pace of development, the Precision Medicine Initiative and other programs that MMRF is leading, do you predict a tentative timeline by which we can expect to see myeloma cure?
I wish. You know, I'd say where one topic that didn't come up earlier, and this is another program that we launched last year that we call the Prevention Project. And, you know, really the goal long term would be prevention, but in the short term, can we prevent progression from smoldering to active myeloma? The next backing up, can we prevent progression from MGUS to smoldering, that kind of thing. You know, that program, again, it's only been up and running for the past 6 or 7 months, probably is our best shot of getting to cures if we can prevent active myeloma from ever happening. You know, I think it's still too early, you know, for a patient diagnosed today. But what we, you know, what we certainly, that's always our overarching goal. But in the meantime, you know, can we continue working with the entire community to extend patients' lives and, you know, at the same time not, you know, have them on therapy forever or not, you know, have a terrible quality of life because of the side effects of therapy. So again, you know, meaningful life extension, but also meaningful quality of life.
Thank you, Anne. Another question, what advancements can we expect to happen this year in high-risk myeloma management?
Well, certainly the launching of our MyDrug protocol is important. We also, so, you know, kind of stay tuned for that. That is a study that, you know, as we talked about, is for first relapse, so it'll be somewhat of a narrow population. But we are also launching another platform, multi-arm trial, of immunotherapy specifically. And that's kind of an interesting one because that trial was pretty much all ready to launch in the fall of last year, and that's when the data around Keytruda or pembrolizumab came out, and FDA halted all PD-1 and PD-L1 trials of any disease, or in myeloma, and in any combination, any of those agents. So it forced us to, and probably it was better that we hadn't launched, it forced us to rethink, you know, kind of re-put that together. And so we're planning to launch this year a new another immunotherapy multi-arm trial, and that will specifically be for relapse refractory patients. So high risk, you know, obviously can be defined in so many different ways. There's genomically high risk. Then there's, you know, I'd say at some point, you know, most relapse refractory patients fall into that category simply because their likelihood of responding to a treatment or responding very long becomes lower. And as we start to see patients progress off of Darzalex or daratumumab, those patients probably should be called high risk as well. So this trial would be for those patients. Again, not genomically high risk, but high risk in terms of in need of new and better options.
Thank you, Anne. I think we left one of Gary's questions unanswered. Again, you've been mentioning clinical trials for high risk patients. So what are the other trials that the MMRF feels can be the next steps to treatment and cure? That's one question. Probably you could just mention some of the clinical trials that are in process or in development that patients need to keep track of.
Yeah, so, you know, through us, I think the two big ones launching are, you know, these two platform trials. Yeah. And then we have a number of other trials, both molecularly targeted We launched last year for the first time trials in plasma cell leukemia and also patients with amyloidosis. So those are ones that we're doing. I think, you know, across the board, the excitement around CAR T is undeniable. And some of these other, you know, antibodies and immunotherapy approaches using the same targets like BCMA. So we are, as I mentioned in my drug, one of the arms we're looking at would be using possibly a BCMA bite in the non-mutated arms. One of the other things we launched or announced last year was a $15 million investment in immunotherapy. Because, and this is kind of a perfect wrap-up to all this discussion, for a long time, you know, precision medicine was genomically based. We're now seeing that, or, you know, our view is that immunotherapy should be precise as well. When we look at, you know, these patients who have unbelievable responses to, you know, some of these CAR, to the BCMA CAR Ts, why is that? So we committed $15 million to advancing, you know, some of the most exciting immunotherapy like CAR T, but also to invest heavily in correlative studies to understand who's most likely to benefit. A tremendous amount of enthusiasm still for genomics, but it's only part of the answer and may not be relevant for a lot of patients. Immunotherapy certainly requires a lot of investment and attention as well.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you so very much. And keeping us abreast with all of MMRF initiatives and progress. We're almost to the end of the talk time right now. So Gary, Jack, Cindy, and Matt, thank you all for your participation and the questions. And this talk will be made available on CureTalks website. So please visit curetalks.com for details of our upcoming talks. Thank you, everyone. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you, you too.
Thank you, Anne.
Thank you.